This next slide that I'm going to put up on the screen is not on your handout, but I know some people are going to say, oh, I've got to write this down real quick. I'll get it to Clyde so we can hand it out next week. But I was just thinking back through the chapters that we've done, and I've said the positions that I'm advocating from, I think, a right understanding of biblical teaching in this class have ended up being what would be called more conservative positions politically. And there's an alternative to that, and that is more liberal political positions. And I kind of thought back through these chapters and thought, what is the heart of liberalism, political liberalism, in these different areas? And I came up with this. Way back in chapter 5, we talked about the courts. The heart of liberalism is government. The power of government should be held by educated elites, that is the judges, rather than by elected representatives. And so judges should make the majority of our decisions about important things in society rather than the population. That's the heart of liberalism in the courts. And I said that is the biggest problem facing the United States today. Chapter 6 and 7, with regard to sexual morality, the heart of liberalism is complete sexual freedom. Therefore, there should be no laws against abortion, because that's tied up to having no consequences and responsibility for having sex outside of marriage. And it leads to societal approval for homosexual conduct rather than sexual responsibility in marriage. Well, that's liberalism in sexual morality, and that has political implications. In education, the heart of liberalism is controlled by educated elites, again, that is by teachers rather than by parents over what is taught in the schools. In economics, and I should say also there's a profound secularism in educational emphasis of liberalism. In economics, the heart of liberalism is equality of income rather than freedom and productivity. And I said governments can make everybody equal in poverty, as Cuba, Russia, other communist countries have proved, but you can't make everybody equal in prosperity. And then in the environment, the heart of liberalism is fear of using resources rather than joyful and wise use as God intends for us. So now what happens when we come to national defense? It seems to me the heart of liberalism is pacifism. That is, saying it's evil to use weapons and soldiers and military power to defend yourself even. The heart of liberalism is pacifism and sometimes anti-Americanism rather than a strong military. So I just thought I'd just give that. Does that helpful at all? Just to see that and when I look through that list, these weaken a nation again and again. They weaken a nation in terms of morality. They weaken a nation in terms of being able to control its laws. They weaken a nation in terms of having quality education and education according to moral standards that parents think are right. They weaken a nation in terms of economic productivity. They weaken a nation in terms of restrictions, more and more restrictions on the use of the environment and use of resources. And, of course, they weaken a nation in terms of the military power of a nation. So now, let's, with that background, look at this outline on National Defense Part 4, Nuclear Weapons. The first and only example of the use of nuclear weapons in history happened on August 6th and 9th, 1945, in Hiroshima and Nagasaki in Japan, where the United States dropped an atomic bomb on August 6th. The Japanese government did not surrender, and so the United States dropped another bomb on August 9th, 1945, and then 6 days later, the Japanese government surrendered with an unconditional surrender, and World War II was over. I wanted to specify a couple of things there. First, these were cities that had very significant military and industrial capability for Japan, and they were significant militarily. It wasn't just an attempt to destroy a population. But many, many people were killed in those nuclear explosions. And between 90 and 150,000 were killed in Hiroshima, and about 80,000 killed in Nagasaki, so about 200,000 people killed immediately or shortly thereafter because of radiation and fires. Now, nothing like that level of destructiveness had ever occurred before in the history of the world. I was trying to get in my mind some sense about what happened with large conventional bombing in World War II before these atomic bombs. And just my guess is a large bomb dropped in World War II could have destroyed the whole worship center at the whole building of the worship center at Scottsdale Bible Church, for instance, or this whole building, but probably one bomb wouldn't have destroyed both. Now, some of you may know more about that than I do, but I'm just thinking what would be the size of the bombs. And so there were a lot of bombs that were dropped in World War II, and they destroyed large sections of cities, but other sections were left untouched, and buildings were still standing. The bombs dropped at Hiroshima and Nagasaki absolutely destroyed everything for a 1 mile radius. Now, to get a sense of what that is, I got out a map of Scottsdale and said, well, what is a 1 mile radius from the intersection of Scottsdale Road and Shea? Just up the road here. Which direction are we? Just up here. 1 mile from... So to get a comparison, if an atomic bomb had been dropped at Scottsdale and Shea, it would destroy everything as far north as Cactus, as far east as Hayden, as far south as Doubletree Ranch Road, and as far west as 64th Street. That's a 1 mile radius. Compared to just one building being destroyed, that's a 1 mile circle is about 3.1416 square miles. And you can imagine that the people of Japan were terrified by that. But I want to say that, that destroyed everything within a 1 mile radius, and then there were fires that destroyed much within a 2 mile radius. And so that would be as far north as Thunderbird, as far east as the 101, as far south as about McCormick Parkway, and as far west as 56th Street. That's a 2 mile radius. But I say that to say it's the most horrible kind of destruction that has ever happened in warfare at any time. But also to say I think we have to remove from our minds the stereotype that if an atomic bomb is dropped in the United States, the whole nation will be destroyed. That's not true. I mean, if an atomic bomb, God forbid that anything like this would ever happen, but if an atomic bomb of the size of Hiroshima or Nagasaki were dropped at the corner of Scottsdale and Shea, people at Paradise Valley Mall would still be okay. And people at Desert Ridge Mall would be okay, and Fashion Square Mall, and the Scottsdale North Hospital. Do you see what I'm saying? It's the bomb of that size had an immensely destructive power, but it was still limited. And then there was fallout. So if the wind is going in a certain direction, then for 30, 40, 50, maybe more miles, then the dust, radioactive dust falls, and then people get... Then they can be killed by radioactive fallout. And so the United States government, within the last couple of weeks, put out guidelines for what to do in case of a nuclear attack. They said, stay indoors at least for an hour or two, or preferably for 24 hours, because then the fallout loses its power and it's pretty safe to go outside again. It's interesting the United States government did that. So I wanted to say that to say let's at least understand what we're talking about. Now, what if nuclear bombs are more powerful than the Hiroshima or Nagasaki? Then perhaps it goes to two miles radius or 3 miles radius. But it doesn't mean the whole nation is destroyed. That's what I'm trying to say. Does that make sense? Now, was it right for the United States to do this, and what was the purpose? The purpose was to end World War II. The military advisors who had taken much thought and planning about an invasion of Japan to attempt to stop World War II were estimating that it perhaps would cost another 500,000 American lives in order to conquer the military power of Japan and bring the World War to an end. 500,000 American lives plus perhaps an equal number of Japanese lives lost before the nation would surrender. And so President Truman made the very difficult decision that he would drop those bombs to say, we have this immense military capability now, and to say to Japan, stop this war. And once those two bombs dropped, and Japan didn't know how many more we had, they said, we cannot pursue this war anymore. And the war was over. So I believe that that was a very difficult decision, but a very right decision simply in the sense that it deterred an aggressor from continuing its course of attempted world domination. It protected the United States from invasion, and it stopped the war. And 200,000 lives were lost, but perhaps a million lives would have been lost otherwise to pursue the war. Since 1945, despite the proliferation of nuclear weapons to other nations, no other nuclear weapons have been used. So 45 to 2010 is 65 years. For 65 years, no other weapons have been used. Why? Because the destructive power is so immense that no nation wants to risk retaliation from the United States, for example, if it would seek to attack us. Since 1945, several nations have acquired nuclear weapons. The United States, according to the data that I have, has 5,113 operational nuclear weapons. 13,000 have been dismantled since 1988. Russia has about 5,200. But there was a New START treaty signed just a couple of weeks ago, I'll talk about in a minute. Other nations, United Kingdom has nuclear weapons, that's number three. Number four, France. Number five, China. Number six, India. Seven, Pakistan. Eight, North Korea. And likely number nine, Israel. That's nine nations out of the world, out of, 193 or 200 nations in the world, something like that, that have nuclear weapons. Iran is aggressively seeking them. Iraq was trying to build nuclear weapons. It was stopped by Israel in 1988 when Israel bombed a nuclear facility in Iraq and stopped Saddam Hussein from producing nuclear weapons. Al-Qaeda is currently seeking nuclear weapons. So that's the status of the world now. Why should we retain a large number of nuclear weapons? The purpose, we say, why? Well, why do we need that? Well, apparently the idea is this. We have three delivery systems for nuclear weapons, airplanes, bombers, missiles, and submarines. And the thought is, if a war began, perhaps the other side would destroy a number of our nuclear weapons before they could be launched. Perhaps others would fail in their delivery, and perhaps others wouldn't reach their target or something. And so it's to provide extra level of protection. Now, some people say, oh, that's still too many. And that isn't a decision that I'm really qualified to make. That's a decision that military experts are to evaluate. Can the world successfully abolish nuclear weapons? This has been President Obama's desire, and he's spoken before the United Nations and said that he is seeking to have a world free of nuclear weapons. Other people have said that. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California said in 2009, nuclear weapons are not a deterrent, but a grave and gathering threat to humanity. And so the question is, will worldwide nuclear disarmament ever be possible? Well, my answer is no. Why? Because the history of the world shows that once weapons are developed, they're never completely abandoned. I don't know if you realize, but there was this wonderful decision in 1139 AD at what's called the Second Lateran Council. They agreed that nobody would ever use crossbows again in war. Didn't work. People still used crossbows. And then when airplanes were invented, there was a convention at The Hague in the Netherlands, 1899, and the Hague Convention had this wonderful peace-loving agreement that nobody would ever drop bombs from airplanes again. 1899. Didn't work. Why? Because Jeremiah 17:9 says, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it?" There is evil in the hearts of human beings, and in some human beings, as we talked about before, the tendency to do evil or the drive to do evil is so strong that they cannot be dissuaded by negotiation or reasoning or compromise, but can only be dissuaded by the use of superior force. And so when somebody says, "I think we have such hope that we're going to rid the world of all nuclear weapons," I hear that person as saying, "I am hopeful that the whole course of human history will be reversed, that human beings will act differently from how they've acted for as long as human beings have been on the earth since Cain killed Abel." I don't think that's a rational basis for hope. I don't think it's a wise strategy. I think rather we should say, well, we realize that nuclear weapons are present in the world, and the question is only how to seek to wisely to prevent their use. And so, it seems to me that total disarmament is an irrational defense policy, not based on reason. There was an article in the Wall Street Journal December 27th, just 2 days after Christmas, editorial by Mark Halperin, a writer on military history and military systems. He says, "We have been and we are steadily disarming, even as we are at war. Based upon nothing and ignoring the cautionary example of World War II, we are told that we will never face two major enemies at once." And he's arguing that this is not a rational policy. Well, how can we reduce the risk of using nuclear weapons, which we should certainly seek to do? And that's number one, deterrence by the credible threat of a superior nuclear force. Why, when Russia was aiming, or the Soviet Union was aiming at world domination, trying to take over more and more countries of the world, why did they never use nuclear weapons to try to take over Western Europe? Why did they never attack us with nuclear weapons? Because they were assured that we would retaliate, and England and France would retaliate against Russia and bring unacceptable destruction to Russia. And so that the threat of nuclear weapons, as awful as it seems, has prevented the use of nuclear weapons for 65 years now. So it's worked. Deterrence has worked. And I think we need to be thankful for that. But second, more wonderful than that, an anti-missile defense system that will prevent nuclear weapons from reaching their targets. And this began with President Reagan. I think it's a wonderful development. So let me go point, this is points one and two under C. Number one, I think the United States has a responsibility to maintain a clearly superior nuclear force that can defeat any potential attacker, to protect its own people according to the responsibilities in Romans 13, 1 to 4, and to protect its non-nuclear allies. We have more than 30 allied nations that depend on us to protect them in case of nuclear attack. For example, did you see Canada on that list of nations that have nuclear weapons? No. Why doesn't Canada have nuclear weapons? Yeah, we have them. So Canada thinks, and I think rightly so, that we would defend it if it were attacked. Canada, you know, is very close to Russia. The Wall Street Journal says over 30 nations that don't have nuclear weapons are depending on our nuclear weapons as a protection and deterrent. If we disarm, then what happens to them? All of a sudden they think they've got to get nuclear weapons. And some of them are nations like Saudi Arabia, for instance. Perhaps ones that we wouldn't want to have. Number two, anti-missile defense systems could stop the need for immediate nuclear retaliation and stop nuclear explosions to begin with. This was an idea that began under President Reagan. It was ridiculed by Senator Ted Kennedy and the press, called the Star Wars, kind of a dream that would never work. But it is working, and a lot of these anti-missile defense missiles have been deployed already in Alaska and California. I think it's a wonderful alternative because it says if there's a nuclear missile coming toward us, we shoot it down rather than letting it explode and then fire back at the other nation. And you say, well, shoot it down. What if it explodes? In these tests, what happens is the detonator doesn't detonate the nuclear weapon, so it just kind of falls harmlessly into the ocean. That's wonderful, I think. All Christians who love peace and believe in the protection of human life should rejoice greatly that military technology has advanced to the place where these systems work. Example, January 26, 2002. Now that's over eight years ago, almost nine. A ground-based interceptor missile fired from a Navy ship hit a dummy armed missile in space that had been fired over the Pacific. September 1st, 2006. A missile was launched from Kodiak Island in Alaska. This is an American missile simulating an attack. And a silo at Vandenberg Air Force Base, that's in California, isn't it? Went up and shot it down in the middle of its flight. And then, very interestingly, just 11 months ago, February 11th, 2010, a Boeing 747 jumbo jet equipped with a massive laser gun, shot down a Scud-like missile over the Pacific. The laser in this 747 fired a heated basketball-sized beam. There was a missile flying at 4,000 miles an hour, and this laser beam traveled 600 million... Wait a minute. Okay, the missile's going 4,000 miles an hour. The laser beam travels at a speed of 670 million miles an hour, and it destroys the Scud missile. So 4,000 miles an hour is pretty slow compared to a laser beam of 670 million miles an hour. It's gone. Now, if you watched Star Wars, you knew all along that that was going to happen. But I think that's great. People said it would never work when President Reagan proposed it, but it seems to me a wonderful, wonderful antidote to the use of nuclear weapons. During 2009, however, it became increasingly clear that President Obama would pursue the opposite strategy from what I've advocated here. Now, I'm going to read what I wrote in this book that was published in September, but then I need to correct that because within the last month, President Obama's policy has changed in a positive direction, I think. And I want to be fair and indicate that as well. But during 2009, he took several steps to weaken the U.S. nuclear weapons arsenal. He sought a new treaty with Russia that would set a maximum of 1,000 nuclear warheads for each country, United States and Russia. He sought to kill the Reliable Replacement Warhead Program, which would modernize and update the nuclear arsenal for a long time to come. But if you kill that updating program, then our nuclear arsenal is subject to gradual physical deterioration. It just kind of gets old and corroded or rusty or something. And then he asked the Senate to ratify the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, But that means that we can't ever test our nuclear weapon systems again, and then our systems become gradually outmoded. But more harmful to world peace was than those things was this, and I deeply regret this action. President Obama, on September 17th, 2009, abandoned a missile defense agreement that President George W. Bush had negotiated with Poland and the Czech Republic to station anti-missile defense systems in these two important countries in Eastern Europe. And I want to put this up on the map. And I still got a problem with having these maps show up. Well, you can kind of see Europe here, can't you? Okay. This is Russia. Here's England, Spain, France, Germany. This large country here is Poland. And just next to Poland, just here, is the Czech Republic. And I didn't know how to make them both dark at the same time from the map I had, but there's Poland. President George W. Bush had negotiated a treaty or an agreement to place nuclear anti-missile defense systems in Poland and the Czech Republic. Why is that important? Because Poland and the Czech Republic are in the middle of everything. If you have a Russian missile launched here toward Germany, France, Spain, England, and you've got anti-missiles in Poland, this missile starts coming up here and you shoot it down. Poland and the Czech Republic are a great place to put anti-missile defense systems. And Iran is way over here. And if Iran starts to shoot at Europe, pow, you shoot it down as well. And if you look on the map of the world up here, if Russia starts to shoot something at the east coast of the United States, Poland is right there and it's right in the way and you shoot it down. This was a tremendous, I think, blessing to the world to have these nuclear defense anti-missile systems placed in Poland and the Czech Republic. And the agreement was all in place, it was ready to go, and President Obama canceled it. Abandoning this program betrayed the trust that Poland and the Czech governments had placed in us, because it was protecting them. It was protecting those other Eastern European former communist countries that were around them. Russia was delighted with President Obama's decision. This decision left Eastern Europe more vulnerable to future Soviet attempts to attack and regain control over it. One Polish newspaper proclaimed, "Betrayal! The U.S. sold us to Russia and stabbed us in the back." A respected newspaper in the Czech Republic said, "An ally we rely on has betrayed us." The Wall Street Journal on the next day wrote this, "The reality is that the United States is working hard to create antagonists where it previously had friends." Officials in Warsaw, Poland, surely noticed that President Obama canceled the missile system 70 years to the day that the Soviet Union invaded Poland. So the Soviet Union invaded Poland September 17, 1939. President Obama canceled the agreement to put missile defense systems in Poland September 17th, 2009, exactly 70 years later. I can't imagine a worse way to betray and insult a country that is now pro-Western, had been formerly communist, dominated by communists, and now was our friend. The Obama administration also canceled the Kinetic Energy Interceptor Project for basing anti-missile defenses in Germany and in Turkey. Why? It canceled this as part of $1.4 billion in cuts to the Pentagon's missile defense budget in early 2009, while it was adding $814 billion in stimulus spending. So we add $814 billion in stimulus spending for who knows what, but we have to cut $1.4 billion from missile defense systems at the same time in early 2009. The administration was so opposed to such military spending that it was the only budget area subject to significant cuts. I think these were tragic decisions, immensely harmful to future national security. Now, within the last 2 weeks, there was something called the New START Treaty. START stands for Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. It was ratified December 22nd, 2010, just 11 days ago, by the United States Senate by a vote of 71 to 26. It needed a two-thirds vote, or 67, to pass. It got 71 with 13 Republican senators voting for it. It says that the United States and Russia will have a maximum of 1,550 strategic nuclear weapons, warheads, deployed by 2018, and it starts inspections again. I think it was a wrong decision to ratify it. However, the Republicans in the Senate were divided on it, and some Republicans were supporting it. I am thankful, however, especially for one senator, and that is Senator John Kyle from here in Arizona, in that he was leading the opposition to this, and he didn't win in opposing it, but he won two very important concessions. Number one, that President Obama agreed again to begin working toward deploying more missile defense systems in Europe, which is good. He gave them up in Poland and the Czech Republic and Germany and Turkey, but he said, okay, I'll start again and go back to the drawing board and get those going. And President Obama agreed to work on modernization of our current nuclear weapon systems, which was something I'd criticized him for giving up. So John Kyle won those two concessions. I still don't think it was a wise decision to sign that treaty, but I think it's not as big a deal as it might have been. So that's where we are, and I'm thankful that President Obama at least agreed that much. Now, I'm going to stop before I go on to talk about the CIA and see if you want to talk about nuclear weapons and what our policy should be for just a few minutes. Do we have, Stephen, we have a microphone here? E.G. has his hand up here. Let's take two or three questions maybe.
I heard something on the radio, and I didn't catch the whole thing, but it was talking about the aspect that there's two major differences in the types of missiles. There's the short range,
yes,
and the long range.
Yes, and this treaty only covered long range.
Okay, so there's still, I understand there's quite an imbalance. I can't remember the numbers.
Russia has a lot more what is called tactical nuclear weapons. Yeah. They're short range.
Okay.
Yep.
By several thousand, I believe.
Yes, it does. And those are a concern in Eastern Europe. And yet this nuclear missile defense system would guard against the short-range ones, too.
Okay.
Those were not covered by this treaty. And the concern is that President Obama will go back to the drawing board. Now let's negotiate these short-range missiles. And then Russia will say, okay, but you've got to agree not to deploy these anti-missile systems. And so that'll all be thrown in the package. And who knows what'll happen? Wall Street Journal said, "Well, let's wait and see." But we've been there, done that.
That's step number two.
That's step number two. That's right. Yeah. Joyce, way over here. Well, but you can't get on the tape. So hold on. Somebody in Poland wants to hear what you have to say.
I just wanted to ask if you know what Obama's logic was.
Yes.
In not having
those nuclear defense systems.
Yes.
I haven't read specific statements from him, but I can tell you in general, the liberal answer is if we put anti-missile systems in place, it will encourage Russia to build more nuclear weapons because they need more to get through our defenses. In other words, the idea is that defending against these things leads to more attacks. I think that's not a rational argument, but it's a pacifist argument. It's saying, those are good people and we're good people. We all have good intentions at heart. Let's just kind of lay down all our weapons. I think when I went back months ago, Joyce, I talked about fundamental Christian worldview assumptions that lead to differences in political conclusions. And here, the fundamental assumption is there's goodness in the heart of every human being. And And, well, not just that there's goodness, but people are basically good. And it denies the profound evil and sin that's in people's hearts and just says, hey, it's the result of bad society, bad upbringing, bad influences. And if we can just talk with these people, and be kind to them, we'll set a good example, and then they'll be kind too. So it's a deep-seated assumption of the goodness of human nature, not realizing the reality that there's evil that leads to war and has throughout history. So that's where it comes from. And I just disagree with it. But because of what the Bible says about Cain killing Abel and wars being fought since the beginning of time. So anything more on nuclear weapons? What's your name? Lisa? Yeah, I've asked you that before. Hold on just a second.
According to the New START treaty, are there any specific steps that Obama will take based on Congressman Kyle's recommendations, or is this just something that he said to appease his opponents?
I don't think the agreements reached with Senator Kyle were part of the New START treaty. The treaty was on piece of paper. Kyle said, well, President Obama, will you agree to put nuclear weapon defense systems in Europe and upgrade our, maintain our system? And President Obama signed a letter saying, yes, he would do it, but it's not part of the treaty. Separate. But at least it's something. And it gets him on record saying, okay, we'll go forward with this. Now I hope he follows through. Okay, so can we go on? CIA? The CIA is the primary organization that gathers and analyzes information about other countries, especially enemies. So the CIA, Central Intelligence Agency, coordinates America's spy network. Seems to me that to know about potential enemies and attacks prior to their happening is a necessity. And I think that the CIA, just by spying, has prevented immense harm from coming to the United States. Does the Bible talk about spies at all? Actually, there are a few. Joshua, the son of Nun, in Joshua 2:1. Joshua sent two men secretly from Shittim as spies, saying, go view the land, especially Jericho. And then in 1 Samuel 26:4, Saul encamped on the hill of Hakilah, which is beside the road on the east of Jeshimon, but David remained in the wilderness. When he saw that Saul came after him into the wilderness, David sent out spies and learned that Saul had come. So is Joshua sending spies, David sending spies? And when Absalom rebelled against King David, David fled from Jerusalem. Absalom came and took over the city of Jerusalem. David was fleeing out to the wilderness. As David is leaving Jerusalem, Hushai the Archite came to meet him with his coat torn, dirt on his head. Hushai the Archite was a wise, high advisor to King David. And he said, I'm going to go with you. David said to me, if you go on with me, you will be a burden to me. Maybe he wasn't in very good physical health. I don't know. But maybe he couldn't walk very fast. Or maybe he wasn't very good with a bow and arrow or with a spear, but he was smart. Okay. So he said, you'll be a burden to me. But if you return to the city and say to Absalom, I'll be your servant, O king, as I've been your father's servant in the time past, so now I'll be your servant, then you will defeat for me the counsel of Ahithophel. That was another wise counselor, but Ahithophel had gone to serve Absalom. Are not Zadok and Abiathar the priests with you there? So whatever you hear from the king's house, tell it to Zadok and Abiathar the priests, and they'll tell it to their two sons. And so Hushai, David's friend, came into the city just as Absalom. So David set up this spy network right in the middle of Absalom's camp. Very interesting. Three instances of spies in the Bible. Apparently, why? For the purpose of finding out about the enemy and what was going on. And the CIA does that. Now, despite the effectiveness of the CIA in preventing harm, unfortunately, it is treated with hostility and criticism by the media and by Hollywood. The CIA is just the villain and the enemy in so many novels and movies. I'm just going to give you one example. Margaret wasn't really excited about it, but we did watch these three movies with Jason Bourne, the Bourne trilogy. And I thought, oh, these are great movies. They're fun. They're exciting. I got to the end of it, and I realized, you know who the bad guys are? They're all CIA people. And that I had read those Ludlum novels, and they're exciting novels, but the CIA wasn't the enemy in the novels, but the movie makers turned the CIA into the enemy. Why is that? It's because there's an anti-CIA mentality in our culture. It seems to me this is unfortunate for the country and highly inappropriate to the crucial work carried out by the Central Intelligence Agency. For the most part. Now, I realize there are sometimes breaches of good conduct and unwise decisions. I mean, these are human beings. But for the most part, the tens of thousands of people who work for the CIA do so at the cost of significant personal sacrifice and often in the face of great danger. It seems to me that criticism of the CIA or its activities in general has a destructive effect on the nation. Why? It undermines the morale of CIA employees who work at dangerous tasks and great personal sacrifice. And it makes it more difficult for the agency to recruit employees and carry out its work. So I don't know if you share this attitude that's common in our culture, that you just instinctively suspect that the CIA is evil. But it seems to me that opposition to the CIA as a general attitude of mind or a general policy is contrary to the very ability of a nation to defend itself. And so I think opposition to the CIA in general is opposition to the United States itself. I agree, it's necessary that Congress will have some oversight of the activities of the CIA and related intelligence agencies. And ultimately, they report to the president. I think that's good. Unfortunately, congressional oversight has too often led to damaging leaks of information, because you get anti-CIA congressmen on these oversight committees or their staff members who are working for them, and then they leak information that have been destructive to the CIA's ability to protect national security. I think if Christians think it is right, according to Romans 13 and 1 Peter 2, for nations to defend their citizens, they should be supportive of the CIA in general, rather than being instinctively critical of activities about which they know very little. And I suspect that the opposition to the CIA probably primarily stems from an anti-Americanism that is out there in the media and educational culture. Maybe that's rooted in pacifism. Maybe it's rooted, perhaps, who knows how much of it has come from just ultimately people who don't seek the good of the United States and are working in certain industries to try to harm the country. I don't know if you want to ask. I'll pause there. That's all I wanted to say about the CIA. I don't think we should ever approve it when it does things that are morally wrong, but I do think it's necessary. That's all. Any questions or comment on that? Okay, good. We'll go on. Coercive interrogation of prisoners. Why didn't I use the word torture? Well, it's because people have widely differing understandings of what torture means. Some people think torture means extreme measures like cutting off a person's fingers or toes or gouging out an eye. Others think if you shout at a prisoner, that's torture. Or you wake a prisoner up in the middle of a night of sleep to ask him more questions, that's torture. And in ordinary English today, torture can be used very broadly. I, in fact, had a member of this class say recently to me that listening to my statistics on water supplies and water resources in the world was torture. I won't divulge the name of the class member. But when the word torture can mean all those different things, it's guaranteed to mess up a discussion if people start using it, because people are really not understanding clearly what they mean by the word. I think this is inexcusable. In March 11, 2007, the National Association of Evangelicals, which is a pretty good group, it's evangelical groups and denominations around the United States, but they released an 18-page document opposing torture, March 11, 2007, but they nowhere defined what they meant by torture. And a friend of mine, Daniel Heimbach, who's an ethics professor at Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina, Daniel Heimbach denounced this statement by saying, while it loudly renounces torture, it nowhere in 18 pages of posturing defines what the signers of the document claim so vehemently to reject. And Dr. Heimbach actually served in the White House staff under First President Bush and was the architect of the just war strategy or policy statement for the first Gulf War. But anyway, because the word torture has so many definitions, I just am not going to use it in this discussion. I'm trying to use other phraseology that I hope explains clearly what I mean. Let's see where we are on time. I think we need to hurry on. McCain's amendment, Senator John McCain, who has been so good on so many defense questions, he said there should be no torture ever. He had an amendment that he proposed that was passed by the U.S. Senate by a vote of 90-9 in 2005 that prohibited any cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment of prisoners. Any. At any time. Cruel, inhuman, or degrading. Under questioning, McCain admitted he did not intend this prohibition to be absolute. When he said, well, what do you do if you found out that somebody's planted an atomic bomb in New York City? He said, well, you have to do what you have to do, but you take responsibility for it. I really think that is a wrongful approach to say we prohibit cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment ever, but then sometimes you have to use it. And the reason is this. Even if a president would authorize extreme coercive measures, and then they find the location of a bomb, they defuse the bomb, New York City is saved, then what happens? The president and any FBI agents or anti-terrorism agents involved in the process later on would be subject to prosecution and imprisonment for violating the McCain Amendment. Well, you do what you have to do, but then if you've broken the law in doing it, it's nearly certain some prosecuting attorney could be persuaded that the prosecution should go forward. So I think Senator McCain's position is contradictory and would prove to be vindictive against those who are most responsible for protecting the nation from attack. Well, then what should the United States policy be? I've outlined that here on this, on the bottom of page one of your outline. It seems to me the standard policy of the United States should be humane treatment of prisoners in accord with the Geneva Conventions of 1949. I've quoted these in my book, but it says people should be treated humanely, should be protected against all acts of violence or threats thereof. Women should be especially protected against any attack on their honor, in particular against rape or indecent assault. However, the parties to the conflict may take such measures of control and security as may be necessary as a result of the war. The idea is you don't, once you capture prisoners, you don't punish them for being soldiers. You treat them humanely. And I think that's the idea. Now, that's our standard policy. However, should there be exceptions? Yes, I think there should be. First of all, if someone enters the United States to carry out a terrorist attack, that person is not part of the group of people covered by the Geneva Conventions. Number one, because he's fighting out of uniform, trying to disguise himself as an innocent civilian. And number two, he's deliberately attacking civilians, trying to set off a bomb in New York City or something like that. So how should the United States treat a captured terrorist if we know or believe that he has planned a future terrorist attack? It's called the ticking time bomb problem. Here, the moral status of this prisoner is different from just a soldier you capture on the battlefield. You capture a soldier on the battlefield, the soldier on the battlefield is no longer engaged in a wrongful activity against you. He's in a prison camp. But this terrorist is right now currently engaged in the immoral and illegal process of concealing information that could save thousands of lives from terrible destruction. So the terrorist that you capture that has this knowledge is currently complicit in mass murder on an unimaginable scale. Does the United States in that situation have the right to use less than humane treatment in order to compel the terrorist to do what? To do what is morally right. To disclose the location of the ticking bomb or the identities and locations of those planning to carry out a future evil attack. I think in that case, the United States has a right. I think the United States has an obligation within some limits that I'm going to talk about in a minute to use compulsion or coercive interrogation. Not to do this would be to completely fail in the government's God-given responsibility to rescue the weak and needy, deliver them from the hand of the wicked, Psalm 82:4. Now, what does a pacifist say to this, or someone who opposes coercive interrogation, such as Pastor Greg Boyd in Minnesota? He says, who are you to say that you are morally right and the terrorist is morally wrong? Here's what he says. You probably believe that our cause is just and theirs is evil, but the terrorists passionately believe that their cause is just and ours is evil. Your passion for American justice is mirrored by their passion for Islamic justice. That form of argument is common among politically liberal people. It's called moral equivalence. It's saying the United States and terrorist nations or others who attack us, we're equal morally. We think we're right. They think they're right. Nobody can tell. My answer is there are two very significant differences. One, terrorists are attacking innocent civilians, which we don't do, and which just war theory never allows, which the United States, even the United Nations, liberal as it is, has consistently condemned. Attacking, intentionally targeting innocent civilians, not just attacking a military complex and civilians are killed, but you didn't target them, but intentionally targeting innocent civilians is wrong, and the terrorists are engaged in a war of aggression to conquer another nation and impose Islamic law, which is wrong, according to just war theory. So I think there's a moral difference. They're attacking innocent civilians intentionally, and they're trying to conquer another nation. They're contrary to what we understand to be the right of just or just war theory. It seems to me, therefore, that Greg Boyd has lost all sense of moral compass when he sees Islamic terrorist attacks and American defense against those attacks as morally equivalent. He is simply wrong. And some people say, well, we have to take the high moral ground so people will respect us. It seems that terrorist enemies respect not timidity and weakness, but courage and superior strength. And our allies respect and depend on us to use our strength to defend ourselves. Are there any restrictions on what to do with prisoners, even those who have knowledge of a ticking time bomb? Yes, I think so. I think that no government should be allowed, no agency of government should be allowed to commit actions that are inherently immoral in themselves, such as raping a prisoner, to deny medical treatment, to carry out sadistic humiliation of prisoners, such as what happened at Abu Ghraib, for which military persons responsible were rightly punished. To force a prisoner to violate religious convictions that pose no threat to the United States, such as giving a Muslim prisoner only pork to eat or something like that, that would be, I think, wrongful. And doing things that would shock the conscience of a U.S. court, such as causing lasting physical damage to the prisoner. So I think, no, we shouldn't ever gouge out someone's eyes or cut off fingers or toes or something like that. They don't serve any valid purpose in just obtaining the needed information. So then we say, well, wait a minute, what can we do? Well, it is possible to inflict pain on someone without doing permanent damage to the person. And I have a trivial example, but when a couple of my sons were in high school, I paid for them to take Taekwondo lessons to defend themselves. And after a few weeks, they came home all excited. Oh, Dad, we learned these pressure points. If you push on them, they really hurt. I said, oh, show me. So they pushed on this place in my back, and I said, whoa, let's stop that demonstration right now. And there was a whole lot of pain. Now, that's probably a trivial example, but skilled interrogators, I think, will know much more persuasive examples of inflicting pain. And then the second example is waterboarding, where a prisoner is lying face up with his head lower than the rest of his body, a cloth or towel is put over his nose and mouth, and then water is poured over it, and apparently it gives a sensation of drowning. And it creates some panic, and this has been a very controversial interrogation method. What I think we have to know about that is that thousands of United States troops have experienced this as part of SERE, Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape training, to resist an enemy if captured. And this has been done with the full knowledge of Congress for many years. So this isn't something new. It's something that many of our troops have already experienced as part of their training. And then there was a proposed amendment in the U.S. Senate in September of 2006 to reject all waterboarding, and the Senate rejected it, 53-46. The U.S. Senate and U.S. Congress had oversight of these things and knew this was going on for years. However, President Obama completely prohibited waterboarding in an executive order on his second full day in office, January 2009. I do not think that waterboarding is inherently morally wrong. It inflicts pain and a feeling of panic, and it is apparently very persuasive in getting a terrorist to reveal hidden information. And when used with inappropriate guidelines, it causes no permanent damage. Now, critics say it doesn't work, and you read these expert opinions. Oh, the prisoner will make lies to bring the pain to an end. But that doesn't agree with the facts of history. Former director of the CIA, Michael Hayden, and former attorney general, Michael Mukasey, on April 17, 2009, said coercive interrogation techniques, including waterboarding, brought significant results. It finally led to the capture of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, mastermind of the 9/11 attacks, because people under waterboarding disclosed who he was. And it led to the disruption of follow-on plots aimed at both Europe and the United States. And fully half of the government's knowledge about the structure and activities of al-Qaeda came from such interrogations, including information that helped prevent a second wave of attack in Los Angeles, according to William McSwain, a lawyer and former Marine who was involved in Defense Department reviews of these techniques. In other words, it worked remarkably well. Half our knowledge of al-Qaeda came as a result of such interrogations, and we captured the mastermind of 9/11 and prevented attacks in Los Angeles and Europe and elsewhere. So it did work. It seems to me not to have used these techniques would have been morally wrong. It would have been having the ability to stop the murder of thousands and thousands of people and not doing it. What could be a greater moral wrong than any for any government than this? Not to stop murders when you can. In 2009, unfortunately, the current Attorney General, Eric Holder, began to threaten prosecutions against some Justice Department lawyers in the recent Bush administration simply for writing internal memos arguing that such methods within limits were legal. Prosecutions for writing a legal memo for carrying out what the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel told the CIA was legal? This was simply a vindictive attempt by the highest legal officer in the nation to use the courts to bring retribution against people for holding a different opinion on a widely debated political question. It was an attempt to criminalize political differences after you've won an election. It's done by third world despots, but deeply unworthy of the United States. The problem with that is the harm from that action hasn't ended, even though the threats have receded. The fact that this happened, it will breed institutional timidity in the Central Intelligence Agency and the Department of Justice. And eventually, we are more likely to suffer horrible attacks. Even if a future president reauthorizes enhanced interrogation techniques in exceptional cases, how will the CIA and Justice Department know that some future administration won't release all the details and then attempt to send those involved to prison? The safe route now for government officials is to pamper terrorists, opening the country both to their contempt and to their future attacks. So it seems to me that the campaign against coercive interrogation has significantly weakened the United States in its ability to fight the war against Islamic jihadism. I'm going to stop there and see. I should be at the end right here, but I'm going to take 2 or 3 minutes. I know you probably want to have some comments or questions, and then we'll end. And the homosexuals in the military and women in combat have to wait till next week. Questions or comments on this? Yeah, wait a minute. I'm losing your name. Felix. Tomlinson.
Yeah, Wayne, my comment is on all of this is that it was 65 years ago we used to call those atrocities. We've lost all common sense, and that's all they are, is atrocities. Mm. That's what's going on here, and it's been going on for a long time.
So you're opposed to waterboarding?
No, no, I'm saying that the way we handle it... You're absolutely right. We have to handle it, but the common cause, the civilians, out of uniform, those are atrocities. Yeah. And we put people to death for that after World War II, I think World War I.
The terrorist
attack. Methods during that time. And it's been going on forever, and why are we trying to reinvent the wheel with moral equivalency?
Yeah, good. Do you have a military background, Felix?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, I know you were a pilot. Okay, good. Anything else? Yeah, way in back, Julie, way over here in the corner. Do you know who that is, Ron?
Slightly.
Julie.
Would you define the difference between the coercive interrogation you would apply to a terrorist as opposed to a coercive interrogation that, say, a police force would use against civilians?
I haven't thought about it, Julie. I suppose if... You know, there was a criminal mob, and it was discovered that they had planted a bomb in Los Angeles, I think, and you captured somebody who knew where it was, I suppose the same argument would apply. I think infliction of pain without permanent damage, and only such as is necessary to extract the information, done in very limited circumstances and very unusual circumstances. Yeah, go ahead. I suppose. I don't know what the laws are.
The presumption of innocence in our, you're innocent until proven guilty, whereas my feeling from you at this point is that you're presuming the terrorist guilty, assuming he has knowledge that he needs to divulge, and thus you use coercive interrogation.
Yeah. Maybe not guilty of planting a bomb, but guilty of having knowledge that is needed to prevent murder. I don't know. Steve or anybody else, you want to tell me, any lawyers want to tell me what, maybe you don't deal with criminal law. We're in estate planning, not another time. You want to say anything, Steve? No? Okay. Yep, over here. One more. What's your name?
Ramsina.
Ramsina.
I'm from California. I'm visiting.
Oh, yes.
I just wanted to comment on what the previous commenter said, that those laws about assuming innocence, before proven guilty, that applies to the United States citizens, doesn't it? I mean, that does not necessarily apply to non-citizens or terrorists in this case.
Well, not someone... I think there are different laws when you have reasonable reason to conclude that the person has entered the country secretly for the purpose of carrying out a terrorist attack. I think there are different anti-terrorism laws. I'm not familiar with the details, but thanks for raising the distinction. Okay, tell you what. What did you think about this today? This isn't normally what we do in church, if you're a visitor. but I think it's good that we talk about it. Yet I think we're kind of, oh man, this is serious stuff, and this is worrisome stuff. Let me pray, and then we'll close. I'm going to skip the hymn today, and we'll wait. I was going to sing What a Friend We Have in Jesus. You can sing that in your own mind as we leave, because I'm going beyond the time. Lord Jesus, we thank you that you are wise and good, and you rule over nations, and you raise up one, and you put down another. These are hard questions, Lord, and they're questions that involve, in some cases, great harm to human life. And Lord, we ask, and I ask, that I would not treat these things with any attitude that is inappropriate, but with care and solemnity and even reverence before you and with trembling because of the seriousness of the questions involved. And yet we pray, Lord, too, that you would give each of us wisdom as we evaluate political questions and seek to vote or influence those who make decisions in our government. We pray for wisdom for President Obama and Vice President Biden and the members of the Senate and House and the Supreme Court and others in authority over us, that you would help them to understand your purposes and your ways and to govern wisely in a way that is pleasing to you, and that you would have mercy on us yet and yet continue through your grace to pour out protection and blessing on this nation and through this nation to other nations of the world as well. We commit ourselves now into your hands. In Jesus' name, amen. See you next week.